This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 176 was recorded on July 18th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersOnPlug.com, the leading podcast when it comes to systematic trading and investing. Author Jim Rickards is back as this week's feature interview guest, and we'll discuss the content of his latest book. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will discuss Ray Dalio's latest article, which concludes by saying something that we've said many times over here on Macro Voices, which is that gold will be an important asset to own in the 2020s.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 earlier in the week was making new highs, and we've since been backing off from there. We're just below 3,000 on the level at the time of recording. What's your thinking here on the S&P 500?
You know, Patrick, I listened to the last few episodes, and I seem to just say the same thing about the S&P every week and get longer-winded every time. So I'm going to try to tighten it up. Look, what I've been waiting for is what Ray Dalio in this article we're going to talk about in postgame calls a paradigm shift. We've been in an environment where central bank liquidity has been the driver of higher asset prices, and that's ultimately unsustainable. Someday it has to end and reverse, and that's exactly what Ray Dalio says. Now, I've been thinking it's long overdue and surely about to be here. It's very interesting. You know, Ray Dalio is certainly far more accomplished than I am. He says it's coming, but could be a couple years still. So I don't know when it's happening. I do know that this market doesn't make sense to me. But as far as wanting to get excited about shorting the market or something, no, I'm not doing that because the market's not doing what I think it should be doing. And I don't see any reason to think, just because I think so, that it's going to change. So let's go deeper into Ray Dalio's perspective in postgame.
Let's move on to the U.S. dollar index, where it seems to be making higher lows but lower highs, consolidating sideways in a chop. But what's surprising is that when you go to the euro just looks so weak, even the pound sterling breaking to fresh lows. It seems like the dollar may have a shot here on the upside. What's your thinking?
Well, I'm sad that it hasn't dipped down to 96 on the September contract because I'd love to buy more there. And I think that would form a right shoulder on an inverse head and shoulder pattern. And if that were to occur, the target of that head and shoulders would take us right up into the major resistance zones at 97.50 and 98. And those are definitely the areas to watch. A breakout above 98, I think, would signal a move much higher. There's plenty of smart people that disagree with me and think it's topping here. So the ultimate test is going to be, you know, daily close or better yet, a weekly or monthly close above 98. In the meantime, I still think it looks very bullish.
All right. Well, I've been waiting all week to ask you about crude oil and what's going on here, because as of Monday till now, we've just seen close to $5 wiped out to the downside. Is this a major reversal? Are we going lower here, or is this just a blip?
Well, I think that we're going lower until something changes. And, you know, as I've said for weeks on the program, I feel that the economics have been calling for much lower prices for several weeks. But the thing is, as long as you have escalating tension with Iran and big inventory drawdowns at the same time, obviously, we're going to keep pushing higher and higher to the limits of how high it could go. I think we found how high it could go, and both of those two drivers fell out of the market this week. We had President Trump making a comment that they're ready to negotiate with Iran. Now, I'm not as persuaded as the market is that that really is bearish for prices. I don't think necessarily that ready to negotiate and ready to make concessions are necessarily the same thing. But one way or another, the market took it as Iran is de-escalating rather than escalating further. And in the very same week, we got a much, much smaller drawdown in crude oil inventory. So let's start with EIA. crude oil drawing down 3.1 million barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 1.4 million barrels, gasoline, though, building 3.6 million barrels, and distillates building a massive, massive 5.7 million barrels. So, yes, it was still a drawdown on crude oil. But there are several factors to take into account here that really make this look bearish as opposed to bullish. The first one is, yeah, it's a crude drawdown, but it's offset by a much larger product build. The other factor is, it was a hurricane week. Imports are way down because the ships can't get in and out of Houston due to the hurricane in the Gulf. Production is down as a result of 15 rigs being evacuated in the Gulf of Mexico. So it's no surprise. Now, remember, though, these are weather-related anomalies. They're not necessarily the beginning of a new trend. So the tape action was down hard in reaction to the Iran news from President Trump, down even harder in reaction to inventory news, although I would point out that there was a pause there. The market didn't really rifle lower the way it sometimes does in reaction to inventory. It was a slow reaction. Then eventually people thought it through and said, too many factors that are bearish here. Ended up closing way down on the day on Wednesday, inventory day, with more follow through today. Now, U.S. production was down to 12 million barrels from a high of 12.4 million barrels. That would normally cause me some concern. It would make me to start to worry that maybe we're seeing a trend reversal here. But again, you've got to consider the hurricane effects. You've got production that was affected by all these rigs in the Gulf of Mexico being shut in temporarily to weather the storm for the hurricane. So we can't go by this week's number or next week's number because they're going to be affected by weather effects. Imports were down to 6.8 million barrels, exports down to 2.5 million barrels. Now, the reason I'm skeptical of this de-escalation is, first of all, until now, President Trump has been very clear and very committed to this policy of very firm negotiations with Iran. If you think about President Trump's history, you know, Donald Art of the Deal Trump has been very, very concerned about oil prices. He's done things in the past to send false signals that would kind of shock oil prices lower. If he wants to get tough with Iran, which I think may be what's really going on here, it would perfectly be in character for him to say, we're ready to negotiate with Iran in a way that he knew was going to cause the market to assume that meant we're ready to make concessions and so forth. Oil prices go down, which is what he wants. And then when they get into that actual negotiation, we find out that actually they're not really willing to make a lot of concessions. Maybe I'm completely off base with that, but I don't think that we have sufficient information to conclude right now that the Iran situation is de-escalating. It looks that way, or the market is interpreting the signal that way. We'll see what ultimately happens. But certainly prices are headed down. And at this point, we hit this afternoon, I had a tweet out. We almost got to $3 on what's known as the five-day gap, the gap between the current price of WTI crude oil. Actually, as I'm looking at my chart as we're taping, we just hit it again, back to $3 of five-day gap. That's the difference between the current price and where the five-day moving average is. It doesn't mean that there's not more downside. I think there probably is more downside coming unless we get a different signal on what's really going on with Iran. But the thing is, we're oversold here and we're way overdue for a bounce. So we've got to narrow that five-day moving average gap. And that can happen either of two ways. As we're speaking and recording now on Thursday afternoon, we're right at about $55. The five-day moving average is all the way up at 57.93. So either we see a big bounce up to narrow that gap, or we see a little stabilization and trading sideways here to allow the five-day moving average to catch down to the current price. But the gap being more than $3, it's very unusual for that to be sustained. So I think we're probably due for a bounce here. I do think that there will be further downside, and I think there's plenty of room to see prices go right back down to $50 if and only if the Iran message continues to be one of de-escalation. I won't be surprised if that changes.
All right, well, let's move on to gold. And we're edging up once again to 52-week highs. Not there yet, but edging there. What's your thinking here on where gold's going next?
Well, we've been in a consolidation range between 1390 and 1440. So a decisive break with a daily close, or better yet, a weekly close above 1440 is super bullish. There's just no denying that. On the other hand, if we saw a break below 1390, that could be either of two things. It could be just a setup for a very, very common pattern in technical analysis, which is where we would see a retest of the breakout zone, which is somewhere between 1350 and 1377. We would test that as support before moving to a much higher price. The other possibility, of course, is it could be the beginning of an actual breakdown to much lower numbers. Now, most people disagree with me on the dollar. I think the dollar has room to break out here and move much higher. The fact that so many people disagree with me means that most of them are not positioned for it. And that means that if I'm right, the break will probably be a big and sudden one that catches a lot of people wrong-footed. That could spell serious trouble for gold if it happens. And again, I could be wrong about the dollar. Now, Ray Dalio commenting in his recent article that we'll discuss in detail in postgame that gold is the place to be was huge news. Ray Dalio is one of the most influential people in finance anywhere, widely regarded as the most successful hedge fund manager in existence anywhere in the world. So the fact that Ray Dalio said gold is it, and we didn't see an instant reactionary, you know, knee-jerk move above 1440, actually surprised me. Now, to be clear, Ray is talking about the next decade, not the next month. But the way markets tend to work is, you know, it's Ray Dalio said it. Oh, my gosh. You know, buy gold. Everybody buy, run and be in a frenzy. So that didn't happen, which actually surprised me. The thing to remember, though, about Ray Dalio's view, he's talking about the reasons that gold is going to be the thing to own in the next decade. And that's something that we've been saying for years on Macro Voices, that gold, I've said, will be the asset to own. The thing is, gold can go down to 1,000 before moving sharply higher, and Ray will still be right, exactly right, in everything he says in this article. So the fact that Ray Dalio is saying buy gold doesn't mean that it has to go up from here. That's really not the call that he's making. He's not trying to make a tactical call. The thing, though, Patrick, as you said, is we are, even in the time we've been speaking about gold, we've moved another dollar higher. We're well above 1430 now. We got another 10 bucks to the upside in a daily close there, and you've got a really serious bullish signal. So the balance of evidence is suggesting that the move higher in gold is already happening. The place where I do see a surprise factor is if I'm right about the dollar, it would probably result in some kind of pullback for gold. Maybe what happens is I'm right about the dollar and that just gives us the pullback down to 1377 again, and it goes all uphill from there. But I think if you're buying gold here, you do have to be concerned about the dollar. As I've said before, I think the way to hedge that is to be long gold and long the dollar at the same time.
All right. Well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields, because after a week of rising yields, I think we were near 215 at one point. We're back down to around the 205 level on the yield. Do you think another spurt to the downside's coming here in the yield?
You know, I hope not, just because I was waiting for it to back up a little more. I was hoping we'd see 220 or so I could buy on the long side of this trade. I'm carefully watching it, but I don't really have a strong opinion. I think that Ray Dalio makes an excellent argument counter to someone like Jeff Gundluck or even Julian Brigden, who think that we're headed to much higher interest rates. Dalio says central banks have so many reasons to not allow that to occur that he expects that we will get to a stabilization, but then we'll just stay at zero for a long time. So we'll come back to that. The other thing, I don't remember if we've mentioned in past episodes or not, but we're seeing more and more negative yielding junk bonds in Europe. This is utterly ludicrous. Negative yielding junk bonds is going to be something that will go down in the history books as one of the craziest things ever to happen in the history of finance. And that doesn't mean it's time to jump on board and short them here, because the fact they got negative in the first place was crazy. It's not that much more crazy to see them get more negative. So we're into just utterly nutso logic in at least some isolated parts of the European junk bond market. Who knows how much farther that can go?
All right. Well, thanks for the update. Now, before we go on to this week's featured interview with Jim Rickards, please give us a quick update on the emails we've been receiving from our listeners about our expanded content.
Well, Patrick, I was really inspired by a couple of emails we got this week. Dr. Steve Bickle wrote in with a suggestion. Steve applauded us for doing all that we can do to keep Macro Voices free by looking for sponsorship rather than moving to a paid subscriber model. But since he knows that we're starved for cash to produce all of the new content we've been producing until we find more sponsors, Steve just decided to set up a recurring monthly donation on PayPal in the amount that he said he would expect to pay if we were a subscription service. Now, for Steve, that number was $50 a month, equivalent to $600 a year, which is what he figured a subscription ought to cost based on the value that he derives from Macro Voices. So he wrote to me and suggested, hey, why don't you explain the rationale that led me to this, and maybe other people will follow in my footsteps. We also got another email from a listener who expressed the view that he, too, wants to donate, but he's a little bit worried that he could end up having to pay twice if we eventually do move to a paid subscription model and he has to buy a subscription after he just made a big donation. That's a really good point that I hadn't thought of. So what he suggested and what we're going to do is to simply make a policy of counting any donations that we receive after January 1 of 2019 as prepayments toward a paid subscription if we're ever forced to go that route. So you'll be able to apply any donation you make now toward paying for your subscription if we're ever forced to charge you for a subscription. So consider that done. We do keep track of all the donations and we'll credit them, you know, as I've just described. Our strong hope is that we won't have to do that. We want to secure the sponsors that we need, and we really need our listeners' help in doing that. So if you work for a company that would make a good sponsor for Macro Voices, please let the appropriate people in your company know about us. But I certainly agree that we should protect our donors in this way. So I hope some of you will consider following Dr. Steve Bickle's example. Decide how much value you derive yourself from listening to Macro Voices every week and set up a recurring donation that automatically donates whatever amount you feel is fair for the value that you derive. It's very easy to set up recurring automatic monthly donations using the donate button on our homepage at macrovoices.com, and any donations that you make will be counted as payments if we ever have to charge for a subscription model.
Oh, thanks for the update, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is Jim Rickards. Now, Eric, why did we invite Jim back onto the show this week?
Jim's books have been super popular, and we've also had a number of requests to get him back on the show. We haven't had him on since, I think it was the book before his last book. So his new book is coming out next week. It seemed like a good time. And this episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Top Traders Unplugged. Although I'm a global macro investor myself, it's a fact that quant-based strategies are dominating the rankings of top-performing managers. These are rules-based strategies that remove human emotions and therefore can be well-researched and tested. And this year, they're off to a flying start. And there's one podcast that covers this area of finance better than any other. TopTradersUnplugged.com. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can even get a free book explaining how these systematic strategies can work for you. Just go to TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro to claim your free copy. Again, that's TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro. Check them out. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Jim Rickards is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at MacroVoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Jim Rickards, best-selling author, and Jim has a brand new book coming out next week. It's available now for pre-order on Amazon and through other outlets. The title of the book is Aftermath: Seven Secrets of Wealth Preservation in the Coming Chaos. Jim, thanks so much for joining us. I want to start with what I think is really the core issue behind just about everything else we talk about in economics, which is just burgeoning debt around the world. And I think, you know, sovereign debt is what we tend to focus the most on, but frankly, the private debt problem is just as big. And I feel like the world ignores this. At what point is the question that's always on my mind? At what point do we get to where the breaking point is reached and the bad predictions that all the smart people like yourself have been making for decades, finally we hit that breaking point and things start to break. So give us a little bit of perspective. I know you cover this early in the book about how there's been a progression of debt increase, and it's not linear. So give us the backstory.
Sure. It's a great question, Eric. And by the way, in terms of predictions, I was in I was in London in what they call a capsule on the London Eye. That's the big Ferris wheel, you know, on the South Bank of the Thames on June 20, 2016. And I looked in the camera and I said, the UK is going to vote to leave the EU and you should short sterling and buy gold. We put that out ahead of the vote. Of course, the vote was a shocker that the UK did vote to leave. And I got emails after that, you know, thanks for putting my kids through college, because I took your advice on that. And there was a lot of profit made from getting that right. And then in late October, early November 2016, I was traveling around the world, Australia, Europe, and then in New York, and kind of looked in the camera on a lot of networks and said that Trump was going to win the election, and pretty much got laughed at, but we got that one right as well. I use proprietary models. They're quite different from what government officials in Wall Street use, but we've actually been getting very, very good results in our predictive analytics. But yeah, you ask a bigger picture question, which is what about the debt? You know, you can go all the way back to David Stockman in the early 1980s. He sort of got a smart guy, nice guy, I know David, but kind of got booted out of the Reagan administration for sounding warnings about the debt. And here we are, you know, 35 years later, the debt's much bigger, and the end of the world doesn't seem to have arrived. So there are two things. Number one, when most people talk about it, they talk about high debt amounts. The metric I use is the debt to GDP ratio. And the way I explain it to people, you know, if you owe $25,000 on a credit card, is that a problem or not? Well, if you make $25,000 a year and you owe $25,000 on the credit card, you're probably going to go bankrupt. But if you make, you know, $500,000 a year and you owe the same $25,000, you can probably pay it off with one check. So in other words, you can't understand whether the debt's a problem or not unless you compare it to your capacity to pay the debt, which is, you know, income for an individual or GDP in the case of a country. So I look at the debt to GDP ratio. Now, what's interesting about that is a lot of people just assume kind of naively that, well, you know, George Washington became president in 1789 and started borrowing some money, and we've been borrowing ever since. And here we are, you know, at $23 trillion, which is the U.S. national debt today. And it just kept going up and up over the course of U.S. history. That's not true. First of all, we had national debt before we had a nation. When George Washington was sworn in, we already had some national debt left over from the Revolutionary War. And the Congress said, well, we have a simple solution. Just don't pay it. You know, that's the American way. Just default. And it was Alexander Hamilton who said, no, what we should do is borrow more, pay off the old debt. And then after that, we can borrow more and pay off the new debt and just keep rolling it over. And that was the creation of the U.S. Treasury market, the U.S. government securities market. It's been working very successfully for the, 230 odd years ever since. But the debt did not go straight up. It went up and then it came down and then it went up and then it came down. It's much more of like a wave, a sine wave than a straight line. Well, what's the driver behind that? Well, generally, and it's more than general, it's pretty high correlation. Debt goes up in times of war. We borrow money to fight a war, whether it was the War of 1812 or the Mexican-American War or the Civil War, et cetera, and then we pay it off in times of peace. And there's good reason for that, because you want to have some dry powder. If you take U.S. debt capacity to the limit in times of peace, and then so where's your capacity to borrow more if you actually need it for something more existential, such as a war? So the pattern has been up and down. In fact, in 1836, at the end of Andrew Jackson's administration, Jackson did two things. He paid off the national debt. We actually had zero debt in 1836, less than when George Washington was president, and he got rid of the central bank. So from 1836 to 1913, starting with no debt and no central bank, we had a great period of prosperity. But the sine wave has now been broken, and that's the news. That's the disturbing part. So at the end of World War II, the U.S. debt to GDP ratio was about 120%, the highest it's ever been in U.S. history. Well, you look back at that and say, well, yeah, but we had the Great Depression. We had to try to, you know, spend our way out of that. And then we had World War II, where you don't care how much you spend because you have to win the war. So people understood that. But from 1946 to 1980, so think, you know, Harry Truman to Ronald Reagan, that debt to GDP ratio was whittled down from 120% to 30%. At the end of the Carter administration in 1980, early 1981, it was 30%, which is a very low, very manageable ratio. And what impressed me about that was that it was continuous. In other words, it was not a partisan issue. You had Democrats and Republicans. So Democrats, you know, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter, and Republicans, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, they worked together, and along with the Fed and the Treasury, and they got that down. And so that's the most impressive example of what I'm describing, which is it goes up during war and down during peacetime. Now, Reagan took it up again. You know, this idea that Reagan was a fiscal conservative, it's not true. Reagan was a big spender. Reagan took the debt to GDP ratio from 30% to 50%. But he won the Cold War. So, you know, the Cold War wasn't as much shooting as these other wars, but it was just as much of an existential threat. So I give Reagan credit. I was like, yeah, you spent a lot of money, but you had Star Wars and a 600-ship Navy and a lot of other technology, and we won the Cold War. So based on the pattern I'm describing, as I say, which is well over 200 years old, what should have happened after that would be the debt would come down. Now, George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, again, one Republican, one Democrat, they kept a lid on it. They didn't get it down very much, but they kept it from getting higher. And at the end of the Clinton administration in early 2001, the debt was $5 trillion and the debt to GDP ratio was a little over 50%. So nice job keeping a lid on it, but they didn't bring it down very much. But that's okay. That's still a manageable number. But there we ran off the rails. George W. Bush, Bush 43, doubled the debt from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. And then Obama in two terms doubled it again from a higher base, from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. So just, I mean, just think of that. And when Clinton left, doesn't seem that long ago, it was $5 trillion. Today it's $23 trillion, and Trump's thrown another trillion on top of it. So all of a sudden, two things have happened. Number one, the pattern of trying to bring it down. Yeah, I understand we had a 9/11 and a war in Afghanistan and the Iraq war, which was sort of a war of choice. So you can make a little bit of allowance for that. But nothing really during the Obama administration and nothing so far during the Trump administration. Yet those three presidents, Bush, Obama, and Trump, have taken the debt from $5 trillion to $23 trillion, not in a time of war. Now we are completely off the rails. The pattern, this 200-plus year pattern I described, is broken. And something else has happened. The debt to GDP ratio is now 106%. Now, what's new is that there's some very good research. And here you have to look to Carmen Reinhardt and Ken Rogoff. And they have an 800-year study in their book. This time it's different. But they have more focused studies over the last 200 years, even the last 100 years, with a large database of countries. And what they show, and to me it's very convincing, it's all publicly available, of course, is that when you get to 60% debt to GDP, you're in the danger zone. You're not completely off the rails. And this is why Angela Merkel in Germany tries to keep Europe under 60%, and Germany is. But when you get to 90%, now you're in the red zone. What happens is you can still borrow more. It doesn't mean there's a debt crisis. But what it means is that you can't grow. All of a sudden, you know, Keynes said in a depression or a liquidity trap, you can borrow money and increase aggregate demand and kind of grow your way out of it. There's some truth in that if you're starting from a low base, a manageable base, if you're in a recession or a depression or just coming out of one, and there's a lot of slack in the economy. If all those conditions are true, which they were in the Great Depression, that can work. But at current levels where unemployment's at 50-year lows, capacity's tight, we're in the 10th year of a recovery, not a recession, and the debt to GDP ratio is sky high, what the Reinhardt-Rogoff research shows is that more debt actually slows you down. You cannot borrow your way out of it. You cannot. Borrowing doesn't give you growth. It actually just keeps you in a rut. Well, that's where we are now. So you've sort of got people running around Washington trying this Keynesian approach. Oh, let's just borrow more. But the evidence is that it doesn't work. So the problem, Eric, is that it's not that there's going to be a debt crisis tomorrow. There could be, but I'm not forecasting that. What I'm saying is that we've got a different crisis, which is no growth. We cannot get enough growth. If your debt's growing at 5, 6, 7% of GDP, which it is, but your economy is only growing about 2% in real terms, or even, you know, 4% nominally, if you want to throw on inflation, which it is, then your debt's going up faster than your growth. So how do you grow your way out of that? You can't. How do you pay it off? You can't. And so today, debt is a headwind to growth. Now, how are you going to pay off the debt? And people say, well, we can't pay off the debt. Well, you don't have to pay it off, but you do have to roll it over, meaning you have to borrow enough new to pay off the old debt, pay the interest, finance new deficits if you have any. So it's not like you got to pay off $22 trillion tomorrow, but you do have to maintain a bond market and you do have to maintain your borrowing capacity. Well, how do you do that? Well, there are three ways. One is growth. Next one is inflation. If you get enough inflation, the debt kind of melts away. And the third is just outright default. I won't pay you. Well, let's just look at those three things. I just explained that at these levels, you're not going to get the growth. You're not. And we've had a 10-year expansion. Yeah. But average growth is 2.2%. All expansions since 1980, the average growth is 3.2%. So if you think that a percentage, one percentage point doesn't sound like a lot, it is. Because, you know, growth is kind of in a narrow range, maybe, you know, -4 to +5 at the extremes. Well, since 2009, when the expansion started, a 1% difference in growth compounded over 10 years, that's about $4 trillion of missing wealth. That's how much richer the economy would be and we would be if we'd had 3.2% growth instead of 2.2% growth, $4 trillion. So that's the cost of low growth and that's the cost of high debt. So we can't grow our way out because we have too much debt. We can't get inflation because inflation is psychological. I mean, think about it. The Fed's been trying for 10 years to get inflation to 2%. They haven't been able to do it. They touched 2% briefly, and it turned right around, and now it's back down to 1.6%. So I like to say it's a sad day when a central bank wants inflation and can't get it, but that's because they don't understand what causes inflation. It's not money supply, and that's nonsense. It's behavioral. It's psychological. It's velocity. It's people's level of confidence and their inflationary expectations. So we can't default because we can just print the money. We can't get inflation because of psychology and lack of velocity, and we don't have the growth. So how do we get out of this? Well, the answer is you can't. You're either going to have a crisis, you're going to eventually get to inflation, even though we're not there yet, or you're just going to basically have no growth as far as the eye can see, which is Japan. So I like to say the U.S. is Japan. So the point is, just to kind of wrap up, the debt problem, can you have an acute overnight debt crisis that would lead to something worse in 2008? Yes, that is possible. But it's not the only danger. The other danger is just a slow slog where you look like Japan. You don't have dynamic growth. Your debt to GDP ratio keeps going up. It's like you're in a lifeboat, but it's sinking. It doesn't have to capsize immediately. It can sink slowly, but you still end up underwater.
Jim, something that I've noticed is as people start to become aware of these issues, the first human reaction you have to listening to David Stockman or yourself or Jim Grant is, boy, we got to do something about the debt. But if there's anything I've learned, you know, what you and I think is not important. What's important is to look at what society as a whole is actually doing, what the trend is, what they're likely to do next. And modern monetary theory is all about a whole philosophy that says, look, don't worry about any of this. We have a deflationary backdrop. This is an opportunity to monetize whatever the hell we want. We can do all kinds of social programs. We can provide universal basic income, free health care, forgive student debt, and we'll pay for all of it by monetization. Obviously, that's completely at odds with what you and I might think is sanity. But I think it behooves us to just accept that whether we agree or not, that's what's happening in society. So how do you see this debt situation playing out if you and I are afraid that we're coming to a total reset of the IMS because of too much debt? But really, the trend in society is let's make some more.
Well, first of all, I think that's a very good capsule description of what's going on, Eric. So I agree with your overview or your description. Right, modern monetary theory, I've actually met with and spoken personally to a lot of the leading advocates. I think the big brain in this is Stephanie Kelton. She's a professor at Stony Brook, State University of New York. Paul McCulley, former, I think, number two guy at PIMCO for many years, is an advocate of this. Warren Mosler, former hedge fund manager, now lives in the U.S. Virgin Islands, a perennial congressional candidate from the Virgin Islands, smart guy. But I've spoken to all of them personally about this. And I have to say, modern monetary theory, of all the things I've debated, and I've debated, you know, whatever, gold, cryptos, debt, you know, you name it, it was difficult for me to form the rebuttal. My gut instinct was that it was wrong. It couldn't possibly be the way forward. But the way it's presented is so kind of at least superficially appealing that it took a while to actually develop the rebuttal. So anyway, here's what they say. So the U.S. debt to GDP ratio I mentioned is 106%. Well, Japan is about 250%. So they look at that and go, well, you know, if you apply to Tokyo, it's not like people are living in tent cities, you know, the way they are in San Francisco. It's actually a very prosperous economy. The lights are on in the Ginza. Things seem to be doing fine. So you sort of say, what's the problem? Debt to GDP ratio is not a big deal. And it used to be the case. So when you hear things like, you mentioned a few of them, healthcare for all, free tuition, forgive student loans, Green New Deal, you know, child care for all, guaranteed basic income, you know, whatever it is. It used to be there was a simple answer to that in a policy debate. You would just say, yeah, well, interesting, but we can't afford it. And then that would shut down the debate because you look at the numbers I described earlier, you say, yeah, you're right, we can't afford it. But now when you say to them, we can't afford it, they say, yes, we can. What's the problem? Just borrow the money. And if the treasury market gets a little bulky, then the Fed can monetize the debt, stick it away on your balance sheet for 30 years and, you know, collect it at maturity. What is the problem? We're not using our debt capacity as aggressively and as extensively as we can. And by the way, when you ask them for, you know, empirical evidence of that, they point to our friend Ben Bernanke. I mean, Bernanke kind of proved that you can print as much money as you want without adverse consequences. Now, Bernanke and Yellen, although she actually kind of came in when they were trying to get it under control, but Bernanke printed almost $4 trillion. Now, new money. Now, he did it for different reasons. He was trying to run a zero interest rate policy, trying to bail out the banks. You know, if the banks had didn't have to pay anything for their liabilities and could lend it 2%, leverage it 10 to 1, you get a 20% return on equity, what's not to like, kept Jamie Dimon's bonus in good shape. So Bernanke was doing it to bail out the banking system and protect Jamie Dimon. But, you know, Stephanie Kelton, by the way, Professor Kelton, she's a well-known economist, but she's also the chief economic advisor to Bernie Sanders' 2020 campaign. So, you know, Sanders, we'll see how he does. But if Sanders ever became president, you can bet that Stephanie would be, you know, something, you know, Deputy Secretary of Treasury, head of the OMB. You'd see her in a very prominent position. So this is real. These people are making headway in the political system. But she would say, hey, if you can borrow $4 trillion to prop up Jamie Dimon, you can borrow $4 trillion for the Green New Deal. Or you can borrow $4 trillion to forgive student loans or guarantee basic income or really anything you want. Bernanke proved you can do it. His reasons were different from theirs, or his goals were different from theirs. But as far as printing money is concerned, Bernanke kind of proved that it's not a problem. So when you put it that way, when you say, well, you know, Japan has a much higher debt to GDP ratio, Bernanke proved that you can print a lot of money and not, you know, get hyperinflation or destroy the world, and we have other priorities. When you say all those things, it's very hard to rebut. Like, how do you shut down? How do you rebut that? How do you answer that? Well, here's the answer, and it's something that they don't even think about, and that's usually, you know, what most people's blind spot is. It's true. There is no legal limit on how much the Fed can print. There, in the short run, at least, there is a legal limit on how much the Treasury can borrow. There is a debt ceiling, but the Congress routinely raises the debt ceiling, so that has never been an impediment, and people would not see it as such. And there's no limit on how much the Fed can print. They can. I once had a dinner with one of the members of the Board of Governors of the Fed. And I said, it was probably after a half bottle of wine, but I said, you know, you're on the board of an insolvent bank. The Fed is insolvent. And she said, no, we're not, you know, on a mark-to-market basis, not on a historical cost basis. I said, the Fed's insolvent. She said, no, we're not. And she goes, no one's done that calculation. I said, well, I have, and I think others have. And then she kind of harumphed and said, well, maybe, but central banks don't need capital. And that hit me right between the eyes. Like, well, legally, you're right. Central banks don't need capital. They can take it as high as they want. So they say, what's the problem? And there's one more element. This is critical. So what about confidence? What about the psychological aspects? Now, the MMT, the modern monetary theory, people say, well, that's irrelevant because the government makes you pay taxes and only dollars can be used to pay taxes. Try paying your taxes with gold or silver or soybeans sometime. I mean, they won't take it. They'll take dollars. So as long as the government forces you to make dollars to pay your taxes, you cannot reject the dollar. You're locked into a dollar system. And this is actually called the state theory of money. And this, by the way, modern monetary theory, there's nothing modern about it. This goes back to the early 20th century. And it's not much of a theory because there's not much empirical evidence to support it. But anyway, that's what they call it. So they say, no, you're forced to like dollars, whether you like them or not, because it's the only way you can pay your taxes. So just follow that through. Say, well, okay, what if you don't pay your taxes? I'm not advocating that, by the way, but just as a thought experiment, what if you don't pay your taxes? Well, you get some nasty letters from the IRS, but then they stop with the nasty letters and they come with a marshal and break down your door and arrest you and put handcuffs on you and take you to jail. You end up in jail if you don't pay your taxes and you don't somehow resolve that with the government. So their idea of confidence in money is achieved at the point of a gun. And it's really a neo-fascist theory, in my view. Fascism defined as, not funny people with bald heads and black shirts, but fascism is just the government controls everything. And that is where they're going with this. Well, that turns out to be historically and factually incorrect. There are, just say Mark Zuckerberg is an example. So he's worth, $100 billion on a good day. How much in taxes Mark Zuckerberg paid? Well, the answer is very, very little because his wealth is from the market value of Facebook stock. He got the stock as a founder, fine. Company was very successful. It's worth, well over $100 billion, maybe multiple hundred billion dollars. His share is worth $100 billion. But if you don't sell the stock, you don't owe any tax. And he's given some to foundations. He sold some. He's written a few checks to the IRS. But my point is his tax burden is minuscule relative to his wealth because it's tied up in mark-to-market gains on Facebook stock. And that's true of many of the wealthiest people in the country. Elon Musk has got his Tesla stock and so on. And it's true of many others. And so the point is, there are a lot of alternatives to taxes. You can leave the country. You can buy assets and just hold them. You can, if it happens to be stock, you get capital gains treatment. So that's a much lower rate than people pay on ordinary income. So it turns out that the tax avoidance mechanism, legal ones I'm talking about, are ubiquitous. And it's really kind of the average working person is the only one who actually pays taxes. They withhold it from your salary and you don't have any shelters. So that's the theory, but confidence is at the point of a gun is extremely fragile. People can get around it. And that's really the danger because if people lose confidence in the dollar, so they're watching the Fed, right? So the Fed goes from today, the balance sheet, M0 is around, $3.5 trillion, give or take. Well, all of a sudden that goes to 4, 5, 6, 7 trillion in accordance with what MMT is recommending. At what point do people just wake up and say, you know what, I may not have a PhD in economics, but I'm out of here. I just think this is unstable. And what they do is they get out of the dollar and they get into everything else. It can be, people talk about gold and silver, that's fine, but gold, silver, land, fine art, natural resources, water, oil, anything, buy a new refrigerator, buy a new car, whatever, just get out of the dollar and get some tangible assets. Well, now you're back to the late 70s. I mean, I lived through that. From 1977 to 1981, the value of the dollar declined over 50%. Now, a lot of people, gold bugs and others, like to say, well, since the Fed was created in 1913, the value of the dollar has declined 95%. Well, that's true, although economists say, yeah, but your wages went up and your income went up and your stocks went up. And so the dollar's worth less, but you got more dollars, so stop complaining. Well, there's more to that debate, but leaving that aside, here the dollar went down more than 50% in 5 years, not 100 years or 110 years, but in 5 years. That was psychological. It wasn't because G. William Miller or Arthur Burns printed too much money. It was because people lost confidence, and they started spending it as fast as they could and getting rid of it as fast as they could. That can happen overnight, and it did happen overnight in the late 1970s. So, Stephanie Kelton would say, well, her solution to that, by the way, is raise taxes. Really? So all of a sudden you have a panic in the dollar, inflation is skyrocketing seemingly out of nowhere, and her solution is raise taxes. Well, that's a nice recipe for collapse, you know, high inflation and high taxes. But this shows you that the modern monetary theorists are, they're kind of, you know, eggheads. They're locked in the ivory tower in the universities. They do have political supporters because what politician doesn't want to spend money? And if you can give them a superficially credible theory to spend as much as they want, of course they love it. But when you look behind the curtain, the driver of inflation is not money supply. It's psychology. It's inflation expectations, which feed on themselves and lead to more inflation, again, almost overnight. And the idea that you could put the brakes on with high taxes is nonsense. The way you put the brakes on is to do what Paul Volcker did, which is raise interest rates to 20% and say, you know, your move, pal, and keep, try to keep the money in the banks, which works, but it causes a very severe recession. The recession we had in 1982 was the worst since the Great Depression. And of course, it was surpassed by the one in 2008, but at the time, it was the worst since the Great Depression. So modern monetary theory is deeply flawed because it ignores the real drivers of confidence, which is not the barrel of a gun, but your expectations. And people are far more inventive, creative, and adaptable than the professors give them credit for. And that loss of confidence can happen almost overnight. So you're setting yourself up for a panic. It's just that they don't see it.
Yeah, it's very interesting, Jim, the way that you describe, you know, Bernanke proving, at least in the eyes of the MMT crowd, that you can borrow $4 trillion and there's no problem. And I guess the way I would describe that is it really is the Japanese who proved the point, which is when you exhibit this kind of fiscal irresponsibility, what happens is the critics come out and they predict that it will lead to a massive crisis. And that crisis never, ever happens. What happens instead is you get locked into decades of economic stagnation that there's really no way out of. But because there's no specific moment of crisis, the critics never get proven right. They never get to point to a specific event and to say, well what really happened is the last 40 years of Japanese growth has been non-existent. It's hard to point a finger at that because there's no event to point to. In any event, I want to move on to the international monetary system. You've predicted, as I have, that the IMS needs to go through a reset. Something I've learned, though, is my reasons are not always the same as others. So give us your reasons why the IMS can't last in its current U.S. dollar at the middle of it form forever. What has to change? Why does it need to change? And how is that likely to go down?
Well, I do forecast this, and I can see how a couple of ways it could play out, not one and only one way, but sort of multiple paths, but you need to consider them all. But I'm not the only one saying this and not the only the kind of analyst who's looking at that. I've heard this in private one-on-one conversations with Ben Bernanke and John Lipsky. Now, everyone knows who Ben Bernanke is, you know, former chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. But I spoke to him privately in Korea, and he said that the system is incoherent. That those are his exact words. And he said, what do you mean by that? And it's like, we have a system. We have floating exchange rates. We have capital flows. We have capital markets. We have bond markets, et cetera. But there's no anchor. You know, what's a dollar worth? Well, it could be worth a certain fraction of a euro. You know, euro is worth $1.12 or $1.11, and it's worth, you know, 7 yuan. And you stop for a second and say, well, yeah, but all you're doing, you're giving me cross rates. You're comparing the dollar to the euro or the euro to the yuan or the dollar to the yuan, you know, where it's worth 105 yen or 110 yen, wherever it is. But all you're doing is giving me cross rates. You have not given me an objective measure, a so-called anchor, something that you can measure all currencies against. And this is why, you know, you go back to 2010, 2011, during the early stages of the European sovereign debt crisis, you know, when you had people like Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz, they both won the Nobel Prize, Nouriel Roubini and others, they were running around with their hair on fire saying, you know, the euro is coming to an end. Greece is going to get kicked out. Spain is going to quit. Go back to the peseta, devalue, lower the unit labor costs. There'll be a northern tier and a southern tier, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I was the one who said, nonsense. None of that is going to happen. Nobody's quitting. Nobody's getting kicked out. The euro is going to stay united. It's strong and getting stronger, and new countries will be at it. Well, that's exactly what happened. Nobody got kicked out. Nobody quit. When I said that, there were 16 members of the eurozone who used the euro. Today, there are 19 members. There are a couple other applications pending, so it'll go to 20. I expect Scotland may join once they break away from the rest of the UK. But the point being, in the early stages of the currency war, the United States set out to have a cheaper dollar. This was announced in President Obama's State of the Union address in January 2010. By August 2011, the dollar hit an all-time low, an all-time low. And by the way, gold hit an all-time high at the same time. Well, that's no surprise because the dollar price of gold is just the inverse of the dollar. So cheap dollar means high dollar price for gold. But the point is, how do you have a cheaper dollar without having a stronger euro? I mean, that has to happen. You cannot have a cheap dollar and a cheap euro at the same time. Those two currencies make up about 80% of global reserves. They can't cheapen against each other at the same time. It's a mathematical impossibility. So if you're seeing a cheaper dollar, running around screaming about the end of the euro is nonsense, because the euro has to get stronger. And it did. It went up to $1.60, you know, in the time frame I'm talking about. It's back down since then. But at the time, it got close to an all-time high. But the point is, this is what people don't understand. Forecasting exchange rates is relatively easy, because if you get one right, you automatically get the other one right, because it's like two kids on a seesaw. If one's down, the other one has to be up. But there's no third metric. There's no thing, object, commodity, or whatever, that against which you can measure everything and to see what they're worth, except gold. Now, gold is not officially part of the international monetary system, but gold is money, in my view, but it's not printed by any central bank. It's not subject to, as I say, quantitative easing. You can dig a little harder in the gold mines, but that's hard work. So the point is, gold is the logical anchor. The reason that was settled on in the period between 1870 and 1914, which is the classical gold standard, or even after Bretton Woods, the reason people settled on gold was because it is the best form of money, and it's not subject to manipulation by governments in terms of physical supply. You can manipulate the dollar price or the euro price, but you cannot manipulate the physical supply. So that's an anchor. So then a few months later, I'm in New York, and I meet with John Lipsky, and I've had several conversations with John, including a great one-hour conversation in Hong Kong last year, which I talked about in my book, Aftermath. This is all in Chapter 6. And Lipsky said the same thing. By the way, people don't know who John Lipsky is. John Lipsky was, until about 2 weeks ago, the only American ever to head the IMF. I mean, today David Lipton is acting managing director because Christine Lagarde's going over to the European Central Bank. But prior to that, there had always been an understanding that you would never have an American as head of the IMF because it gave America too much power, you know, particularly after Bretton Woods. So if you look at all the directors of the IMF since 1944, they've all been Europeans, mostly French, but, you know, some Dutch and Belgium and other nationalities, but mostly French, except that in 2011, our friend Dominique Strauss-Kahn got, you know, arrested on an Air France jet and charged with sexual assault, et cetera, and had to resign. And the board was not ready to appoint a new managing director at the time. So Lipsky, who was first deputy managing director, stepped up to become acting managing director of the IMF, so the first American to head the IMF. So I spoke with him for a long time. He said the same thing. He said there is no anchor. He said the system is incoherent. And it really struck me. I said, wow, I just spoke to Ben Bernanke and John Lipsky, you know, a couple months apart on two different continents, and they both use the same word, incoherent. So this isn't just, you know, me or other analysts or people on the sidelines saying, oh, you got to reform the international monetary system. This is the chairman of the Federal Reserve and the head of the IMF telling me privately that the system is incoherent. So they see the danger. Now, no one agrees on what should happen, and there's no clear roadmap. But the idea that we have an unstable international monetary system that is badly in need of reform is something that everyone agrees on. Or when I say everyone, I mean the elites agree on it, but there's not necessarily an agreement on what should come next. But you know, in my book, Aftermath, this is I have a whole chapter on this, and I relate these conversations. I also spoke to Tim Geithner privately about what would happen in a new financial crisis, because I said to the former Secretary Geithner, I said, well, it seems to me the Fed is out of bullets. They have, if they had normalized their balance sheet and got M0 back down to, you know, pick a number, $1 trillion, okay, you could do QE4, QE5, take it back up to $4 trillion. If you had to, you got a little headroom there. But the Fed has not done that. The balance sheet has not normalized. It's come down a little bit, but not a lot. So the Fed's ability to do QE4 or QE5, take the balance sheet to $6 trillion, let's say. I mean, the MMT people would say, what's the problem? But I wouldn't say that. And I don't think the Fed would say that because they had reasons for trying to get the balance sheet down, which is they're getting ready for the next recession. So there are serious limits there. And then the only clean balance sheet after the Fed QE is the IMF. The IMF actually is not that highly leveraged. The Fed looks like a really bad hedge fund. It's leveraged about 120 to 1. It's insolvent on a mark-to-market basis. The Fed's a mess, except it's the Fed, so no one worries about it. You know, they will in time, but not yet. But the IMF actually does have a clean balance sheet. It's leveraged about 3 to 1. They have a lot of capacity to issue these special drawing rights, SDRs, which are world money. It's not walking around money, as we say in Philadelphia. You don't have it in your pocket. But for the members, the IMF, the countries who get possibly trillion SDR allocations, SDR is worth about $1.40, that's real money in the international payment system and to settle balance of payments deficits, and they can issue bonds and trade it among themselves. So I asked Geithner if SDRs would be the solution to provide global liquidity in a new liquidity crisis. He said no, and he said I disagree with that, by the way, but he said no. He said it's too clunky, it's too slow, there's no consensus, et cetera. And I said, what will it be? If it's not the Fed because they're stretched thin, if it's not the IMF because they're inefficient, what will it be? And he told me, and again, I put this in chapter 6 of the book. So the point is there are multiple paths. You could have a gold standard, which could be loose or strict. You could have SDR issuance, which – my view is likely, but, you know, others disagree. You could have Geithner's remedy, which I don't think will work. But again, I talk about what he told me in the book. There are other things on the horizon. Crypto gold. I'm not a big fan of cryptocurrencies, and we don't have to do a deep dive on that. But Russia and China are working on what's called a permissioned blockchain. A permissioned blockchain is more like a club. It has blockchain technology, but you can only use it if they say you can. So it's like joining a club. They only let the members in. And they're creating, forget Bitcoin, and that's all junk, but they're creating a new cryptocurrency that they control. So we call it the Putin coin or the Xi coin, whatever you want. And both countries have tripled their gold reserves in the last 10 years. Russia has gone almost quadrupled, by the way. Russia has gone from about 600 tons to close to 2,300 tons, and China has gone from 600 tons to just under 2,000 tons. So they've massively increased their gold reserves in the last 10 years. But now they have enough gold that if they issue this cryptocurrency and it's gold-linked, and they invite a network of trading nations. So who would be in the network? Well, it'd be all the people that the United States is trying to sanction. So Russia, China, Iran, Turkey, North Korea, Venezuela. You know, obviously, Venezuela is a basket case. But you could get the other BRICS nation. Now imagine getting Brazil, India, et cetera. Now all of a sudden, you know, Iran sells oil to China. North Korea sells weapons to Iran. China sells infrastructure to Russia. Russia sells energy to China. Everyone takes a vacation in Turkey. You've got this large trading network, but nothing's in dollars. It's all being denominated in this new cryptocurrency, which you could anchor, again, back to the word anchor, to, you know, SDRs or any other unit you chose. And it's very easy to convert SDRs into gold by weight and you have straight through processing. And you don't have to move the gold around on a gross basis. You don't pay for every shipment. What you do is you trade, you use the cryptocurrency to keep score, which is not a big deal. I mean, you can use baseball cards to keep score. And then periodically, you know, four times a year, twice a year, whatever, you settle up in physical gold. But the point is you're settling on a net basis. If you don't need gold to settle on a gross basis, but you only settle on a net basis where, you know, what I buy from you is offset by what you buy from me, you need a lot less gold. You don't need nearly as much gold when you're settling on a net basis and then using the cryptocurrency to keep score. What's missing in that network I just described? Well, what's missing is the dollar. There are no dollar payments. You don't need Fedwire. You don't need SWIFT. You don't need all the arteries and pathways that the United States controls, and there are no dollars involved. So you can't sanction it. And the thing about using physical gold as an anchor, it's physical. It's not digital. You can't hack it. You can't freeze it. You can't intercept it. So now you've created an international trading system, and it might start out small, I'll grant that, but it could grow. But the point is it's immune from U.S. sanctions, and U.S. sanctions are how we throw our weight around and kind of get what we want in foreign policy. So, and there are other plans I discussed in Chapter 6, including what I call the Malaysia plan. I met with several times with Prime Minister Mahathir of Malaysia, who has been very interested in this for decades. He had a famous shootout in September 1997 at the IMF annual meeting in Hong Kong, where there was basically a name-calling shouting match between George Soros and Mahathir, and Bob Rubin had to come in and break up the fight. I was actually in Hong Kong for that meeting. But so this is not a new subject for Mahathir, but I explain how you can have a gold standard without much gold. And the way you do it is you peg your currency to gold by weight, and then someone says, well, here's your currency back. I want gold. And what you do is you pay them in dollars, but you have some kind of operating agreement with, say, let's say the Shanghai Gold Exchange, where the dollars are converted to gold at the market. So what fluctuates is not the exchange rate between your currency and gold by weight. It's the dollar equivalent. So it makes the dollar just another currency. And you have what's called straight-through processing, again, where you send the dollars to Shanghai, they convert it to gold, deliver the gold to you, or keep it in safekeeping. But so you get a de facto gold standard for a relatively small currency like the Malaysian ringgit, but use dollars as an intermediate step, but it's a very quick step because you're working with automated systems on the exchange, and the recipient gets the amount of gold that they've been promised. So that's I call it the Malaysia plan. That's a gold standard without much gold because you're using the world supply of gold to settle your obligations in gold by weight. So, take your pick. You've got crypto gold, SDR backed by gold, the Malaysia plan, other plans, new ones that people could invent. But the point is, something like this is coming. Now, will it be kind of calm and rational, which Bretton Woods was? I mean, Bretton Woods was convened before the end of World War II. FDR and Churchill knew that we were going to need a new international monetary system. They knew the problems of the 1920s and the 1930s. So they said, well, let's not wait until the war's over. And they could see that we're going to win at that point. So let's not wait until the war's over and then say, oh, gee, what do we do? Let's have a conference now before the war's over and set up a system that will govern the post-war world. And they did at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire. So that made sense. You could do that again. I call it the Mar-a-Lago conference. Trump would, and some other convening power, maybe Xi would have a conference at Mar-a-Lago. It could be anywhere. It doesn't have to be a Mar-a-Lago. I just kind of use that as an example. Or will the panic come first and you'll have to do all this on the fly in very chaotic conditions with a lot of stress and a global liquidity crisis, and you're very likely to make a lot of bad decisions when you're doing things on the fly? It'll be one or the other. It'll either be convened or it'll emerge in a panic. Well, why not convene a conference? Why not get ahead of the curve here? But I'm not optimistic that's going to happen. I think it will kind of emerge from a panic.
Well, Jim, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Again, folks, the name of the book is Aftermath, 7 Secrets of Wealth Preservation in the Coming Chaos by Jim Rickards. It's available for pre-order now on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it ships next week, July 23rd, 2019. Jim, thanks so much. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Jim Rickards. I wanted to move on to Ray Dalio's new piece that he put out on a new paradigm. And I thought it was fascinating the way he put it together. What a great piece. I highly recommend all of our listeners read the full article on LinkedIn. And what I thought was really interesting was the fact that he identifies these paradigms, each one of them being about a decade long. and that when you transition from one paradigm to the other in this paradigm shift, that most people get caught overextended doing something that's very popular and then get hurt. And I can't think of a better example of that is like so many Canadians up here, you know, believed that you could never lose money with real estate. And just because real estate every year kept going up, and then they overextend one way and then they get caught the other way. So identifying when the paradigm shift happens is huge, right?
Oh, absolutely. And to be sure, Ray Dalio is, you know, one of the most brilliant people of our time. And he is just so beautifully articulated in this piece. By the way, listeners, you'll find the link in your research roundup email to Ray's article on LinkedIn. I wish we could get him on the program because he's just such an amazingly smart guy. And he's so well articulated what's really going on, which is, you know, every decade he describes in his article kind of has something that defines it from a financial standpoint. And in the case of the 1970s, you know, it was inflation. And what he's saying is this last decade, the one that's ending in 6 months, has been the decade of central bank supplied liquidity. Central banks propping up asset markets by keeping interest rates super low through various artificial stimulation mechanisms. And those are law of diminishing returns. Eventually, that each unit of quantitative easing is less and less effective as you get more and more swollen balance sheets. And what he's describing is you have these unsustainable things. And what always happens is they don't end because they're unsustainable. They go on. They overshoot. They keep going because they've got momentum. And eventually, you hit a tipping point. And markets sort of figure out, hey, wait a minute, this is completely crazy. And what I've been waiting for the last 2 or 3 years is for what Ray is calling a paradigm shift, when the market suddenly figures out, hey, wait a minute, this whole model that we've been in is totally unsustainable. It can't continue. And usually what he says happens is the things that were working and the best end up working the worst. The things that were not working very well at all end up working the best. And he explains that we've got asset prices artificially pumped up by central banks. We've got all of these liabilities coming due in the form of pensions and government entitlements and so forth. And he describes all of the reasons, very similar to the late 1930s, that what has already begun and what he says will continue is just a major battle between capitalists and socialists. And, you know, we're seeing that with Bernie Sanders and AOC and Elizabeth Warren. There is a huge political divide. It results in a huge amount of societal frustration and anger and people taking sides. And eventually what we're going to get to is the realization, hey, you just can't prop asset markets up indefinitely through these artificial means. And Ray is saying it's going to all go into reverse. Now, he's much more accomplished and smarter than I am, where I've been saying it's way overdue. Surely, please, any day now it has to happen. He's saying, look, who the hell knows when it's going to happen? But in the next few years, this whole thing's going to go into reverse and it ain't going to be pretty. And what he says is you can pretty much bet that the central bankers are going to support the bond market. So I think it's a very interesting insight. If you look at something like Jeff Gundlach's views about how we're headed to much higher interest rates, what Ray argues in this article is, wait a minute, why would central banks allow that to happen? They've got a printing press. They don't have to allow it to happen. They've got a lot of reasons not to.
So, Eric, what I actually wanted to do was just quickly jump in here and let's break down what defined existing paradigms. So he identifies four key points. So you just talked about it right here, which is that central banks are lowering those interest rates and printing money, keeping financial asset prices, well, asset prices higher because they're suppressing interest rates and pumping the system with liquidity. Now, the second component, though, which I thought was fascinating, was where he talked about the wave of stock share buybacks, mergers, acquisitions, private equity, venture capital, which has been funded by all of this cheap money and credit. And what was interesting is that he specifically says it's unsustainable. And I thought that was really fascinating because, like, you know, I think that when we go back, 20 years from now, we look back to this decade, and we're going to look back at all those share buybacks and say, was it really that simple that we just had to financially engineer higher stock prices by just pumping huge amounts of debt onto the balance sheets of these corporations and letting them buy their stock price higher? I thought it was really interesting that he didn't think it was sustainable.
Well, you gotta consider though, Patrick, he's very clear in saying it's not sustainable, but elsewhere in the article, he says very clearly, these unsustainable things keep going on. They continue to happen and they overshoot. They go too far to the point where it just seems completely impossible that they could continue. And it persuades most people that they're going to continue forever because it seems as though the people like myself that have been saying, I can't believe it hasn't ended yet, just look stupid. And we're proven wrong and everybody thinks it's going on forever. And it's that point where eventually it does end and it ends abruptly and it's not pretty.
Right. And so his third point, which I want to move on to, is he was saying that a lot of these corporate profit margins grew rapidly due to the advances in automation and globalization, but with the reduced cost of labor. And this is that big disparity where the populist movement you mentioned earlier is being fueled by the fact that there was no wage inflation while these profits of these corporations continue to rise. And you have to think that can't sustain itself and has to mean revert at some point.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that the references to the populism, I mean, you know, so many people, because of their own monetary values and ideology, refuse to learn anything about MMT. And I guess somebody famous, I don't know, Sun Tzu or somebody else said, you know your enemy. Even if you don't like it, you need to understand that there is a huge, huge groundswell of political support for more socialist-oriented policies, you know, more entitlements, forgiveness of student loans and all these things. It's going to be very expensive. And the plan through MMT is to monetize all that. Whether you like it or not, you owe it to yourself as an investor to fully understand what the people you don't agree with are going to do. Because guess what? There's more of them at the moment than there are of those of us who don't think that these things are a good idea.
Absolutely. And so I want to move on now to what he believes will be the characteristic of the next decade as we go into that paradigm shift. And so the interesting thing, which is nothing new to our Macro Voice listeners, which is one, they believe that central banks will run out of this stimulant to boost the markets. And therefore, two, this enormous amount of debt and non-debt liabilities, such as all the pension and healthcare liabilities, will come due. Will have to either be funded through A, reducing what everyone is supposed to get, or two, it's going to have to be funded with larger deficits, which is going to be monetized. And there comes that really interesting idea where whether that's outright MMT or whether some other form of debt monetization, this is something he believes is in our future and in the next decade.
Oh, and I'm absolutely convinced of it too. And I think that it's so important to get your head around, you know, imagine if we did see a major change, not just of who the president is, but what if these Bernie Sanders, AOC kind of views really took over control of the government so that all forces were aligned toward much more monetization in order to provide more social services. It would be incredibly inflationary. It would have all kinds of effects. And it's so important to get your head around these things because I think, I don't know when it's coming, but it seems pretty clear that the direction in society is moving left on the political scale very quickly and toward much more socialization of benefits to people in society.
Right. And so he basically leaves the article, and I thought it was really interesting. He basically says the current paradigm has resulted in a world that is leveraged long, holding assets that today now have a low real and nominal expected return into the future. Obviously, particularly European junk bonds, right? And but also providing historically low returns relative to cash returns. And so we have this everyone over leveraged in this, and they're going to be disappointed, obviously, by the returns that will probably be over the next decade in those assets. And that's where he plugs gold as a diversifier, obviously, within a balanced portfolio. And that's what you were referencing earlier, right?
Exactly. And I think he was actually a little stronger than just to say a diversifier. What he said is, look, you know, you've got to think about what's going to happen, which is central bankers are going to need to support the system. They've created this situation. They can't abandon it. They do have the ability to continue to keep interest rates at zero, whether you and I think that's a good idea or not. They can continue to do it, and they probably will continue to do it. And that means that ultimately all currencies around the world get debased in real value. And that means hard assets like gold are what's going to benefit. And he didn't say it in the article, but I have to believe he would agree that other hard assets like real estate are probably going to do well as well. And Patrick, I'm sure the other thing that's going to do very well is our listeners who are lucky enough to be able to join you in Chicago this weekend. Just for any new listeners who didn't get the memo, tell us what's going on in Chicago, what you and Kevin are going to be debating, and where they can find out more about it if they want to attend.
No, absolutely. I'm looking forward to meeting many of our Macro Voice listeners out there. So if you can make it out, make sure you say hi. And it's going to be great. You know, John Netto is going to moderate a bull bear debate on bonds between myself and Kevin Muir. It's going to actually be a lot of fun. So looking forward to it and looking forward to meeting so many of our Macro Voice listeners out there.
Fantastic, Patrick. I wish I could be there myself. Today's episode was made possible by Top Traders Unplugged. Don't forget to go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro to claim your free book and subscribe to their podcast as well. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. And don't forget to register your free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides links to all of the best content that we could find on the internet, including supporting materials for our feature interviews. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
So this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Jim, as well as the link to that Ray Dalio Paradigm Shifts LinkedIn article. There's also an interesting article discussing Marko Kolanovic's view that there's a once-in-a-decade opportunity in a particular sector of stocks. And as well, there's an interesting piece from David Rosenberg that is talking about the signs of a looming U.S. recession are building. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners. And we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and myself, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.